Got an airplane yesterday at in Montgomery, Alabama, and got in Medford last night about 10 o'clock, and so thankful to be able to be with you all tonight. I bring you greetings from Apologetics Press. Apologetics is a word that comes from the Greek word apologia, which means to give answers or to give a defense. And it says in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, to give answers or to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason of the hope that is in you, in a spirit of meekness and fear. And so I believe it is the Christian's responsibility to try as best we can to give answers to questions that people may ask us. And I've been asked a lot of different questions in my lifetime about Christianity, and most people who wear the name of Christ, who call themselves Christians, will be asked various questions as far as, why are you a Christian? Why do you follow what the Bible says? Why do you believe that there is a God? Why do you believe in Genesis chapter 1? Why do you believe in creation? And, you know, there are many people around the globe and many people in America who have had the impression, because they have encountered various Christians, whose idea about Christianity is, well, we can't really give any reasonable answers for why we believe what we believe. We just believe it. But I believe that is a wrong conclusion to come to, and the wrong way to approach Christianity, based upon a lot of different passages of Scripture that we're not going to deal with tonight, but I will just mention them very briefly. For example, when Samuel, at Saul's coronation, who was the first king of Israel, he told the people to stand still that I may reason with you before the Lord. Isaiah said, come now, let us reason together. When Paul was giving his defense, his apologia, his answer to Festus, Festus said to him, you read about this in Acts chapter 26, you know, Paul, much learning is driving you mad. You're beside yourself. And Paul said, I'm not mad, most noble Festus, but speak the words of truth and reason. And a lot of people 2,000 years ago thought the Apostle Paul was crazy. They thought that Jesus was insane, perhaps because he believed that he was God in the flesh and equal with God, and that he represented God and his message while he was here on earth. And there are many people today who think that Christians are beside themselves and are crazy and maybe are loons or are misguided, or a lot of other adjectives could be used to describe how people view Christianity. Well, for those who are visiting with us tonight who are not Christians, I want you to know that I believe it is our obligation as Christians to do the best that we can to try to give answers to people who have questions. And you may be one of those people who have questions. And we're so glad that our visitors are here tonight. You are, as we often say, our honored guest. And I hope that you'll be back tomorrow afternoon. I believe we start at 4 o'clock tomorrow. Is that right? And we'll have 3 lectures tomorrow night. That is the plan. And then Sunday, 3 more lectures. I recognize in this kind of setting, studying this subject matter, people probably have a lot of questions. And I would like to encourage you to be at all the lectures if at all possible, because our lectures and our books and our writings have been developed over a number of years, and many of them have been written, and the lectures have been organized in such a way, really, as to answer a lot of the questions that people have. And so I hope that you will be able to make as many of these as possible. Not because I'm the greatest lecturer on earth, but I think, number one, the subject matter is very important to study this subject, and number two, I think that a lot of questions that people have will be answered over the course of the next 3 days. I realize that there are a lot of other things that you could be doing tonight than being here inside of this church building studying the subject matter of creation and evolution, but I want to say thank you for your attendance, thank you for being here, and I hope that you will find it good to have been here after the couple of hours that we will spend tonight. We will plan to have a break sometime around 8 o'clock, maybe a few minutes before that, until a few minutes after that. And I believe that Don told me that there are some refreshments in the back, there is a water fountain somewhere around here. And you can get water from that water fountain. And how thankful we should be for a water fountain. Sorry about that. Didn't mean to get any children's hopes up about cookies or anything like that. I do have tomorrow. Tomorrow is dinner. Okay, I do have some cough drops and a few pieces of gum, if you would like that. My wife was actually supposed to be with me this weekend, We were using some frequent flyer miles for her to get here. This is the first time I've been to Oregon. I've been on the West Coast a few times, but never to the great, beautiful state of Oregon. But our oldest son, woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning yesterday with the croup and the flu, and so not able to come here. I don't know if you want to shake my hand or not. I don't have the flu, I don't think. I don't want the flu. If you have had the flu, I think I have a bottle of Germex somewhere around here. You can use this, and I'll use it, and we'll all get along better. So glad that you're here tonight. You know, there are two diametrically opposed explanations to our origins. They're very different stories. And I think it is appropriate to talk about these stories. One of those stories says, to summarize it, and it could be summarized in a variety of ways, in the beginning was matter, which begot the amoeba, which begot the worm, which begot the fish, which begot the amphibian, which begot the reptile, which begot the lower mammal, which begot the monkey, or which begot the lemur, which begot the monkey, which begot man, who supposedly imagined God, and this supposedly is the genealogy of man. More than hearing this described in such terminology as you see on the slide behind me, you see it illustrated a lot more than that. Here is one way that it has been illustrated in the past. I took this picture from a poster that was hanging on a university classroom wall, a very large poster, and this basically illustrates exactly what we just read on the previous slide, and that is that there was matter which somehow gave way to an amoeba, which gave way to the worm and the fish and the amphibian and the reptile and the lower mammal and the lemur and the ape-like creature and then man. This is how it is oftentimes illustrated. Now, what do we mean by evolution? Well, let me quote to you a couple of scientists from the past who have dealt with this subject matter and who have been very well respected in the evolutionary community, especially the second gentleman there, Dr. George Gaylord Simpson of last century. But I'll read George A. Kirkut's. We'll quote these as kind of definitions of evolution, and I believe these are fairly well respected men in their fields of work, and that most people would accept these, generally speaking, as kind of definitions of evolution. What we're talking about tonight is that there is a theory that all living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. That is a non-living form. This theory can be called the general theory of evolution. Some people call it macroevolution, not microevolution. It's evolution on a big scale, not a small scale, if you will. We're not talking about just simple changes. We're talking about evolution from non-living matter to living matter and then to more complex forms of life, just as we saw on the previous two slides. Dr. George Gaylord Simpson wrote in 1960, the same year that George A. Kirkut wrote his book, The Implications of Evolution. He said, evolution is a fully natural process, fully natural. There is no supernatural, according to George Gaylord Simpson, inherent in the physical properties of the universe by which life arose in the first place, and by which all living things, past or present, have since developed divergently and progressively. If we go back to this previous slide of the picture hanging up on the wall or the poster, it basically illustrates even what George Gaylord Simpson wrote about life developing divergently. And let me back up there just for a second. Divergently and progressively in different forms and different ways over allegedly many hundreds of millions of years. Here's how it was illustrated in the U.S. News and World Report just a few years ago. You see that in the smaller boxes that there are more simple organisms, eventually amphibians or frog-like, lizard-like creatures, and then lower mammals, and then ape-like monkey creatures, and then man. And then the implication there by the last picture is, I think, what are we evolving into next? This subject has been in textbooks for many, many years, and those of you who are Christians are very familiar probably with this subject matter because you were taught about the theory of evolution in school. Let me show you a few quotations from from science textbooks that were paid for by your tax dollars. Humans probably evolved from bacteria that lived more than 4 billion years ago. Supposedly, our heritage, our ancestry goes back to, well, bacteria. And we could say that goes back billions of years ago. One textbook was so straightforward as to say, you are an animal and share a common heritage with earthworms. You know, a lot of times people talk about the subject of evolution, but it seems to me that you don't hear so much about the theory, at least as it being carried back as far back as, well, our ancestors really being worms and fish and amphibians and reptiles and lower mammals. You hear a lot about, well, we evolved from ape-like creatures, and you see a lot of pictures, or you see a lot of recreations, illustrations of our alleged ape-like ancestors. But you don't hear a whole lot about how really, well, those ape-like ancestors came from, well, lower mammals, and then those mammals came from reptiles, and those reptiles came from amphibians. So what you're really saying is we came from worms and fish and amphibians. Here's a 1989 general science textbook that talked about how 30 million years ago, larger primates such as monkeys and apes evolved, the earliest fossil apes that may be ancestral to both humans and modern apes date from about 15 to 20 million years ago. The bottom line is, these guys, really, okay, they may not be our just one generation away grandfather, but when you get right down to it, you could just say great, 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 and just go on and multiply that a few hundred times grandparent, maybe a few thousand times. This is supposedly our origins, our ancestry. You know, when I talk to my kids, and I have a 9-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 5-year-old, and we maybe are reading fairy tales, and we're talking about how a princess might kiss a frog, and that frog might turn into, well, it's the next slide there, actually, and that frog might turn into a prince. You know, when I read stories like this to my children, when we see things like this on television, pretty quickly we talk about how, well, those are fairy tales. Those are just stories. And when we read about these stories in a literature class, or when you're in a reading class in school, when you're reading this to your grandchildren, it's very easy to understand that. When we talk about Spider-Man and Batman and Robin, and we talk about Superman, and we talk about a princess or Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, we're talking not about reality. But I want to impress upon your mind that what we hear all around the world by men who have a lot of variety of degrees and who are very educated in the sense that they have higher degrees and PhDs and some of them multiple ones, but it is said that we really did come from apes. This is the cover of Time magazine a few years ago. How apes became human. And hopefully we'll have more to say about this tomorrow in the 4 o'clock session that we have together. But I wanted to show you some introductory slides just to let you understand what we're talking about here in regard to evolution. Dr. Stephen Jay Gould wrote in an article in Time magazine a few years ago about the factuality of evolution when he said, evolution is as well documented as any phenomenon in science as strongly as the Earth's revolution around the sun rather than vice versa. In this sense, we can call evolution a fact. And so evolution is presented not just as a hypothesis, not simply as a theory, though I understand people understand that word in a variety of ways. But when we use the term fact, you know it's a fact that you're here right now. You know that. You know that you know that you're here. You know how you got here. You know what you had, most likely, what you had for supper tonight. There are some things that you know are factual. And when I see the word fact, when you see the word fact, what you understand that to mean is there's no question about it. This is reality. And what we're told is evolution is reality. The general theory of evolution is supposedly a reality. It's supposedly a fact. The most famous atheist in the world today, I believe hands down, is Richard Dawkins. He made a statement some years ago in which he said, it's absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that. Well, Richard Dawkins says a lot of things that bother me. I also have a problem with some of his demeanor as he goes around saying them, but that's really another whole story. I want you to know tonight, if you're visiting with us and you're not a Christian and you're not a creationist, I want you to know that you are our honored guest, and nothing that I say this weekend, I certainly do not want to impugn your integrity or that I want to make you feel less than a person that I fully believe is created in the image of God. And we're glad you're here. I hope that you'll look at the evidence that we're going to present this weekend with an open and honest heart and honest mind. Richard Dawkins says, those of us who don't believe in evolution, that we are, words that I won't even allow my children to use. I just don't like hearing my 5-year-old or my 8-year-old saying stupid or calling somebody stupid, you know. Richard Dawkins says you're stupid or insane, ignorant, or maybe he says even wicked. Well, the fact of the matter is there are many brilliant people, and I wouldn't consider myself a brilliant person. There are many out in the world brilliant people who do not believe in evolution. You know, people have gotten the idea from the media, from movies, from television shows, from news shows, whatever sources they may have gotten it from, have kind of gotten the idea, at least some people have, that all smart people believe in evolution. Well, it's not the case that all smart people believe in evolution. There are a lot of men and women around the world who are very educated and very intelligent who do not believe in the theory of evolution. Now, that doesn't prove that evolution is true or is not true. Just like all of those people with higher degrees who believe that evolution is true and that creation is not. Those things do not make it true or not true. But I want you to understand there are a lot of people around the world who have not bought into the theory of evolution, do not believe that those things that are presented as proof of evolution are really proving evolution. We have several men who write for us at Apologetics Press who have advanced degrees, who are scientists, who are teaching at various universities around the country. One of our writers just finished his PhD in biochemistry from Vanderbilt. Another with a degree in cell biology, a PhD in cell biology from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Before he got his present job, he actually went on an interview where he interviewed for a job, and they felt like he met all the criteria that they were looking for in someone to work at this particular place, and that he had the right degree and he had the smarts, and that eventually, though, he was told once he let them understand that he was a creationist, that he couldn't work there because there were no creationists there. Well, we have seen that kind of those kinds of activities, for lack of a better term. If you've seen the Ben Stein documentary called Expelled, you will see even in that documentary that there have been people around the world who have advanced degrees, who are intelligent people, who do not buy into the general theory of evolution, who either are not accepted to work somewhere, not allowed to work somewhere, or whose influence has been diminished for one reason or another. My point is, there are a lot of brilliant people around the world who do not buy and have not bought into the theory of evolution. And I want to show you a couple of reasons why I believe that they haven't, and I know that some, if not many of them, have not bought into it. Tonight we're going to discuss, in this first lecture, two of the most fundamental basic questions that we could ask. And that is questions about our origins, about where did everything come from, and where did life come from. And we're going to discuss those as we talk about two very real, understandable laws, physical laws that we see in nature every day. One of those laws is called the law of cause and effect. By definition, that law says every material effect must have an adequate cause that came before it, that comes before it. Every material effect must have an adequate cause that comes before it. This is not a law that we define every day. It's not a law that we get out and look in our textbooks to see if it has described it, to see if it gives us the proper definition of it. But it's a law that we accept. It is a truism. It is a fact. And you know that's the case. If I told you that I flew from Montgomery, Alabama to Medford, Oregon on the back of a hummingbird yesterday, you would know that cause is not great enough to make such an effect. If I told you that this cup of water that is right here, well, I'll tell you what, I'll just use my computer. That if this computer, all of a sudden, if 30 seconds ago we all saw it fly off of this table, crashing through two of the back doors, through the window, across the street, into a house, through the house, and then landing in a tree somewhere. And if that was the effect that we saw, and some of you wanted to know what caused that, and I said, well, here is what caused it. I saw the whole thing. I saw a gnat come by in the corner of my eye. Maybe it was one of those floaties. Do you all have those floaties in your eyes? You know, when I first started, I didn't know what was going on. I thought I was catching bugs or something. It was just a floatie in my eye. But we'll just say that I really saw a gnat, okay? And I saw this gnat, and it came along, and it picked up this and just shot it across the room and did what I just said it did. But wait a second. You know that a gnat could not make such an effect. It could not cause such an effect. You're using, when you make that decision, you're using the law of cause and effect. You understand that if I fell down on this carpet right now and broke my ankle and my kneecap and my leg, and you asked me what did it, and I said, well, you know, there was an ant there on the floor that just picked me up and threw me down. Well, that's not a great enough cause to make such an effect. Again, it's easy to understand the illustrations. We don't always define it every day. But when you consider that we use this law all the time, we recognize it as a law, then ask yourself, if the law of cause and effect says every material effect must have an adequate cause that comes before the effect, then what was it that caused everything that we see in the universe? I mean, in the universe. What caused planet Earth? Do you ever think about just the universe? You know, so often we get busy with the hustle and bustles of life, and we are going to and from work, and going to and from a ball game, and to and from maybe a Bible study, or to and from a friend's house. That, you know, we're just, and then in between that, we're just stuffing ourselves with TV and radio, that we forget sometimes to stop and smell the roses. And I'm really trying to teach my kids, hey, you know, you can be plugged into entertainment sometimes, but just stop and smell the roses sometimes. If you just stop and think about our existence and the existence of everything in the material universe, it's mind-boggling and can just about give you a headache when you contemplate how big it is. We live on planet Earth in a solar system with a star that we call the sun. And we're just one planet. And then there's Mercury and Venus and Mars and Uranus and Neptune and Saturn and I don't know, one or two other planets I didn't just name. That planet that used to be a planet that's now a dwarf planet called Pluto. And that's one solar system in the Milky Way galaxy. One solar system, a part of the Milky Way galaxy. And we're told that if you could get outside in your 2005 Toyota Camry, and if you could get out there and drive that thing at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, roughly, approximately, and if you could drive that car the speed of light, go that fast, it would take you, we're told, 100,000 years traveling the speed of light just across the diameter of our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. And do you realize that astronomers, cosmologists say that they estimate that there are many billions of galaxies in the universe? They say that if to get to one of our nearest galaxies, I believe they call it Andromeda Galaxy, that if you could travel again the speed of light, it would take you something like 700,000 years to get there. And that's one of our nearest galaxies, they say. We live in a universe that scientists estimate is 14 to 20 billion light years across. We live in a universe that back in 1981 or 1982 in a Science Digest magazine, they were estimating, that's all they can do is estimate, how many stars are in the observable universe. And they said, well, they estimate there are 25 sextillion stars in the observable universe. 25? What in the world is sextillion? I had to look that one up. You know, once you get, I'm an Okie from Muskogee, okay? You ever heard the Merle Haggard song, I'm an Okie? Well, I grew up in Muskogee, Oklahoma. Once you get past know, hundreds, thousands, millions and billions, trillions. I'm lost pretty much after that. 25 sextillion is 25 followed by 21 zeros, estimated number of stars in the observable universe. And the fact is, cosmologists don't know. I have a friend right now who's working on his PhD in astrophysics at the University of Alabama, just about to finish it up. He said, Eric, we take Hubble telescope that's out in space, and we can shine it to an area in space that's just pitch black, just darkness, and we, you know, magnify and intensify and magnify and magnify, and then eventually we begin to see stars and galaxies. He said, it's amazing. I mean, think about, you know, where does it end? Well, here's what I want you to consider for just a few moments. What caused it? What caused Earth and Mars and Venus and Mercury and Neptune and the Sun and the 25 supposed estimated sextillion stars and the billions of galaxies? What caused all of that? Every material effect must have an adequate cause that comes before it. What caused all of this? Here's what the science textbooks have said now for several years. Most astronomers believe that about 18 to 20 billion years ago, all the matter in the universe was concentrated into one very dense, very hot region that may have been much smaller than a period on this page. For some unknown reason, this region exploded. This explosion is called the Big Bang. So, the explanation is, well, now some of them are saying more like 14 or 13.6 or 14 billion years ago. This particular science book of a few years ago said 18 to 20 billion years ago. Everything in the universe was right there. I mean, it was concentrated into one very small, very dense ball of matter. And for some unknown reason, this region exploded and everything came about in the universe. Now, ask yourself this. You know, when I read that and think, is that really what they're saying is the cause of everything in the universe? It makes me think that me arriving here on the back of a hummingbird is much more reasonable than to think that everything in the observable universe came from a little ball of matter that exploded 14 or 18 or 20 billion years ago. The most famous atheist in the world, evolutionist Richard Dawkins, a few years ago said in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, I'm a biologist. I take the facts of physics, the facts of the world of simplicity, for granted. The physicist's problem is the problem of ultimate origins and ultimate natural laws. What caused everything? Richard Dawkins says, hey, I'll leave that up to the physicist. Well, let me quote to you one of the world's most renowned physicists, at least of a few years ago, who had a lot to do with popularizing Big Bang theory. His name is Alan Guth. In an article he co-wrote back in 1984, he said, the inflationary model of the universe provides a possible mechanism by which the observed universe could have evolved from an infinitesimal region. It is then tempting to go one step further and to speculate that the entire universe evolved from literally nothing. And so, the idea is, the universe came from something so infinitesimally small that you could just about say it came from nothing. Well, that doesn't make much sense, at least from an old boy from Oklahoma, because, you know, if I have nothing in my hand, and I don't ever put anything there, then I'm always going to have what in my hand? I'm always going to have nothing in my hand. Alan Guth was asked a question about the inflationary model of the Big Bang, and that idea is just simply the expansion, the ultra-fast expansion of the universe just after the Big Bang occurred. Well, he was asked later by Omni Magazine, how big was the very early pre-inflation, pre-Big Bang universe? Alan Guth responded, this was back in 1988, he said, amazingly small. How big was that little ball of matter? The textbook said about the size of a period. Alan Guth, who really gave a lot of popularity to Big Bang and the inflationary model of the Big Bang theory a few years ago, he said, amazingly small, about 10 to the minus 24 centimeters across, smaller than a proton, and also amazing it would have only weighed about 25 pounds of matter. Now, this was after he made the previous statement in which he said you could basically say it was nothing. But now he says it's really, 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 really small, but apparently weighed about 25 pounds of matter. Now, either the universe came from something or the universe came from nothing. Which is it? Did it come from a little ball of matter? Did it come from nothing? Did it come from something that weighed 25 pounds? And if it came from something that weighed 25 pounds, where did that 25 pounds of matter come from? You see, here to me it boils down to this. Partly anyway. If you are an atheistic evolutionist, you believe either that something came from nothing, or that matter has always existed, and I don't know very many scientists who believe that, based upon various other laws of science, like the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And if you are a creationist, then you believe that matter is not eternal, and that matter in the material universe couldn't just make itself, so there has to be some kind of cause outside of matter. Let me tell you what one cosmologist, had to say about the Big Bang Theory, the most popular theory for the origin of the universe. Dr. Peter Coles received his undergraduate degree from Cambridge University. You're going to see some of his credentials here. PhD from the University of Sussex. Dr. Peter Coles writes in a variety of publications. I'm about to quote to you from an article he wrote in New Scientist magazine just a couple of years ago. He is an evolutionist. He's a professor of astrophysics at Nottingham University in the UK. He's written over 100 technical articles on Big Bang and periodicals, on the Big Bang, and periodicals such as Nature and Astronomy and Geographics. He's written several books, including The Cosmos to Chaos and a science textbook on cosmology. Now, this guy is not a creationist. He's an evolutionist. But I want you to read what he has to say about the Big Bang. In an article that was titled, at least on the cover of New Scientist just a few years ago, What Put the Bang in the Big Bang? And when I first got this issue of New Scientist that we get where I work at Apologetic Express, I thought, wow, I want to see what the evolutionary community is going to say. What put the bang in the Big Bang? I mean, what gave it its oomph? What caused everything to happen? What is this cause? And Dr. Peter Coles stated in the article, inflation puts the bang in the Big Bang. Well, what's inflation? You know, I want to know what, as the cover said, what put the bang in the Big Bang? Most of us read that and think, what caused the Big Bang? Well, he says, inflation put the bang in the Big Bang. Well, what's inflation? Well, inflation is that which happens after the Big Bang. The ultra-fast expansion just after the Big Bang, he said, through which the universe allegedly went in less than a millisecond, supposedly causing, quote, most of the growth of the 14 billion year observable universe. And so what put the bang in the Big Bang? He says the inflation did. What is inflation? Well, it's the expansion of the universe just after the initial bang. Well, that didn't make a lot of sense to me. He went on to say, there is little... Now, these are admissions from him, okay? I'm just quoting his article to you. He said, there is little direct evidence that inflation actually took place. What's more, we still don't know what could have caused it if it did. So how confident can we be that inflation is really a part of the universe's history? Wait a second. Dr. Peter Coles, I thought you said that inflation put the bang in the Big Bang. Well, he did say that, but he went on to say, actually, there's little direct evidence that inflation actually took place. And if it did... Well, he said, we don't know what would have caused it. He went on to admit, he said, Alan Guth, the gentleman I quoted just a few minutes ago, the physicist who proposed the inflationary theory back in the early 80s, he said, Alan Guth cannot prove that the inflation actually happened, that this inflation actually happened, nor can he suggest a compelling reason why it should have. Within just a few years, inflation had become an indispensable part of cosmological theory. The only problem was that there wasn't a shred of evidence that inflation had actually happened. And yet this is a man who is writing an article that on the cover of New Scientist asks, what put the bang in the Big Bang? He says inflation did, but he goes on to say there isn't a shred of evidence that inflation, that indicates inflation actually happened. Dr. Peter Coles, and feel free to go back and look at this article if you would like, appearing in a 2000 issue. I have the documentation for it, or the citation, the reference for it in a previous slide. He said, we don't know for sure. This is, by the way, this is his conclusion to the article right here. Several of the quotations I've given you thus far occurred earlier in the article. Here's his conclusion to the article. What put the bang in the Big Bang? He said, we don't know for sure if inflation happened. And we are certainly a long way from being able to identify inflation. In a way, we are still as confused as ever about how the universe began, but perhaps now we are confused on a higher level and for better reasons. Now, again, it wasn't a creationist who said this. I didn't make this up. We've got the journal in our offices. But he says, hey, we are as confused as ever about its origins. My contention is, and the contention of creationists is, and Christians, is that the reason there's so much confusion is because they're rejecting the other option, which is a cause outside of nature. There is never going to be an adequate cause found in nature itself. The law of cause and effect says every material effect must have an adequate cause that comes before it. What is the adequate material effect for a 14 or 18 or 20 billion year, light year across universe? What's the rational, logical cause of such an amazing, grand, unbelievably big, gigantic, gargantuan universe? A little ball of matter that weighed, well, some say was the size of a period, some say the size of a proton or less, that may have weighed this, it may have weighed 25 pounds. It's hard to imagine something that small weighing 25 pounds, but that's the cause? Well, see, that wouldn't even be the cause. You have to have something to cause that. And then what caused that? You see, you have an infinite regress. If the cause is somehow natural, matter in nature, and my contention is it's logical to believe, based upon our understanding simply of the law of cause and effect, that there must be something outside of nature to have caused the grand universe and all of nature that we see. Just about a month and a half after the article that Peter Coles wrote in New Scientist magazine, another article came out, another cover story about the Big Bang. I could only think that they did another cover story on the Big Bang. I'd never seen anything like this in New Scientist. We get it every week or every 2 weeks. And just a month and a half later, they did another article on the Big Bang. And this was the Big Bang. What triggered the Big Bang? And I thought maybe they did this because they caught some flack about the first article. I don't know the reasons why. So I read through the article, and they gave various models, various possibilities as to, you know, how the universe got here, what may have brought it all about. This was the conclusion to that April 28, 2008 story by David Shiga. Concluded, the most likely outcome, however, is that none of the models will be proved correct anytime soon. Indeed, the quest to understand the origin of the universe seems destined to continue until we answer a deeper question. Why is there anything at all instead of nothing? And I think that is a very appropriate question to ask. Why is there anything at all instead of nothing? Folks, if there was at some point in the past nothing, nothing whatsoever, then what should we have today? Nothing. How can you get anything from nothing? I believe it is logical. I believe just as Samuel stood up in the days of Saul, just as Isaiah stood up 700 years before Christ, quoting God's word or God speaking through him, or as Paul stood up and talked to Festus, that it is reasonable, it is logical to say that there had to be a cause outside of nature to make nature. It is reasonable. Now some might say, well, what caused God? The law of cause and effect, doesn't it say every effect must have a cause that comes before it, an adequate cause? Well, the answer to that question is simply this, though you may not like it. the law of cause and effect is based upon what we see in nature. What we see in nature, what we see in the material world, is effects have causes. Those effects demand adequate causes that become before the effects in the material universe. That's what we see. But by definition, our God is what? He's not material. He's outside of nature. If this is nature, He's supernature. He's supernatural. If this is material, He is spiritual. By definition, He's outside of nature. And the law of cause and effect does not apply to God. Now, you may not like that answer, but it is the answer. You know, I've heard of some evolutionists who love to point out that you can't prove God using the scientific method. You can't touch God, taste God, smell God, see God, hear God, and prove to someone that God is real. I mean, if someone said right here, Eric, let me see you use the scientific method. Here's your scalpel. Here's some of the other instruments that scientists may use. Here's a microscope. Prove to me there's a God. I want to see Him. I want to touch Him. I want to smell Him. I want to taste Him. I want to hear Him. Well, you can't use the scientific method to prove God in that way. And evolutionists love to point that out. But the fact is, there are some things that we can know based upon observations that know that they demand adequate causes. And see, my experience has been, evolutionists enjoy pointing out you can't touch God, taste God, smell God, can't use the scientific method to prove God, and that's exactly true. Why is that the case? Because God is not material. Because God is not natural. He is supernatural. He is spiritual. He's outside of nature. So no, we can't do that. So when it comes to laws like the law of cause and effect, don't expect those laws to be able to apply to Him because He's outside of nature. I fully believe that the law of cause and effect points toward a supernatural creator and away from the general theory of evolution. You know, atheistic evolutionists, it seems to me, endow nature with the ability to behave supernaturally. Supernaturally. I mean, think about it for just a moment. It seems to me, anyway, that supposedly some have stated, it's ignorant. Richard Dawkins, for example, we quoted him a few minutes ago. It's ignorant and superstitious to believe that God made everything out of nothing. But it's logical and scientific to believe that nothing made everything out of nothing. You see, it seems to me that atheistic evolutionists are endowing the material universe, the natural world, with that which is supernatural. But you can't do that because the natural world is not supernatural. Supposedly, God is an effect and must have a cause. But matter is the uncaused first cause? Again, I believe that atheistic evolutionists are endowing nature with the ability to be supernatural and to behave supernaturally. If God made everything, then who made God? Well, we've answered that question. No one did. By definition, He's eternal. Matter made everything and nothing made matter. Again, I believe that whether it's Dan Barker, who my colleague Kyle Butt debated a few months ago, or some of the other well-known atheistic evolutionists in the world, that when they come to an explanation for where did everything come from, they have to fall back on some natural cause if they don't fall back on God, and yet they attribute supernatural activity to natural causes that supposedly made the entire universe. Our time is rapidly getting away from me, so I'm going to kind of hurry on through the next 10 or 15 minutes here so we can take a break. You've been very good listeners tonight, and I appreciate that very much. Before we go into another law of science in regard to the origin of life, let me just remind us all that for many years people thought that you could get life from non-life. People thought that you could throw a piece of red meat in the backyard somewhere. I mean, this was hundreds of years ago. And that you would find maggots crawling on that meat at some point in time, and that those maggots just spontaneously generated from that meat, from a dead piece of matter. A lifeless matter. And people believe that, my understanding is, for millennia and up until just a few hundred years ago. And then there were scientists like Francisco Reedy and Louis Pasteur who did various experiments back in the 1600s and the 1800s. You recall maybe in some of your science textbooks some of the illustrations of their experience where Francisco Reedy had open jars, some with meat in all of them. Some of the jars were open, some of them were covered with gauze. And so he did a test and he basically concluded that the flies were landing on the meat and they were laying eggs, and that's where the maggots came from, and they couldn't reach the meat in the jars that were covered. And so he concluded back in the 1600s that life doesn't come from non-life. The maggots were coming from the flies. And then a couple of hundred years later in the 1800s, Louis Pasteur did some other experiments and proved on a very small level, that a micro level, that life does not come from non-life. I don't have time to go into all of his experiments, but since that time, it's been generally understood that this is a law of science, that life always comes from life and of the same kind of life. You know, when we go out to a farm and we see a cow give birth, a cow is going to give birth to a cow, and a dog to a dog, and a horse to a horse. A chicken's going to lay chicken eggs and not alligator eggs. That's been going on all of our existence, all of the existence of our forefathers, though they may not have understood that life always came from life. They always knew you weren't going to get a hippo from a giraffe. They knew that. They knew that not to expect a cat from a dog. It's the law of biogenesis, which, by the way, the Bible agrees with, and in the very first chapter of the Bible, we read that at creation, things were creating according to their kind, and that fruit trees were going to have more fruit because the seeds in the fruit were like the trees that they came from. Now, what about the law of biogenesis? Do people recognize this as a law? Oh, they certainly do, and they have for many, many years now, since the days of Louis Pasteur. For example, one of the most famous atheistic evolutionists of last century, Dr. George Gaylord Simpson, said, "There is no serious doubt that biogenesis is the rule that life comes only from other life, that a cell, the unit of life, is always and exclusively the product or offspring of another cell." Biogenesis is the rule that life comes only from other life. Martin Moe, another evolutionist back in 1981, said, "A century of sensational discoveries in the biological sciences taught us that life arises only from life. That in the physical universe, on planet Earth, the only place that life has been found, that life comes only from life and that of its own kind." Robert Jastrow wrote in the 1970s, "According to this story, referring to the theory of evolution, every tree, every blade of grass, and every creature in the sea and on the land evolved out of one parent strand of molecular matter drifting lazily in a warm pool." He says, what concrete evidence supports that remarkable theory of the origin of life? Well, there is none. Let me quote to you from a guy who, from what I can tell, knows more about the origin of life from an atheistic evolutionary perspective than anyone I have ever heard of. His name is Dr. Robert Hazen, Professor Robert Hazen. He received his education from MIT. He has a PhD in earth science from Harvard. He's authored 250 articles, 19 books. Last I checked, he was a professor at the George Mason University. He is, last I checked, president of the Mineralogical Society of America. He's a member of the ISSOL, the International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life. Now, I'm sharing with you some of his credentials just so you can see that he is a very well-to-do man in regard to education, especially in light of his particular field, which is the origin of life. He taught a course on the origin of life. 24 lectures that are recorded and presented by the teaching company. We have those tapes in our offices, where he had an entire 24 lectures dealing with, devoted to this subject of the origin of life. And I want to quote to you some from his lectures. I want you to see what he had to say about the origin of life. Well, if it doesn't blank out on me here. He says, and I have about three or four slides here, maybe five, by him. Please bear with me here. He says, "This course is unusual because at this point in time there is so much that we don't know about life on Earth. The origin of life is a subject of immense complexity. I have to tell you right up front, we don't know how life began. We don't know how life began. He's teaching a class on the origins of life. We don't know how life began. It's as if we're trying to assemble a huge jigsaw puzzle. We have a few pieces clumped together here and there, but most of the puzzle pieces are missing. He went on to say, how can I tell you about the origin of life when we are so woefully ignorant of that history? So right up front, he says to his class, excuse me, he says, we don't know how life began, but he's teaching a class on the origins of life. Notice what else he says. He says, this course, which is on the origins of life, focuses exclusively on the scientific approach to the question of life's origins. Now stop there just for a second. He says, this class, we're going to look at the scientific approach to the origins of life. But notice his very next statement in this lecture. He says, in this lecture series, I make an assumption that life emerged. Let me go back here, if I can. Let me see here. That life emerged from basic raw materials through a sequence of events that was completely consistent with the natural laws of chemistry and physics. Now, I don't want to lose you here, but notice what he says. He says, I'm taking a scientific approach here to the study of the origins of life. But then his very next statement is, now I'm making an assumption. What's the assumption? The assumption is that life emerged from basic raw materials through a sequence of events that was completely consistent with the natural laws of chemistry and physics. Do you see what he is doing? He's saying, I'm teaching a class on the origins of life. We're going to approach this scientifically. I'm going to make an assumption. Life arose from basic... Wait, this would be equivalent, it seems to me standing up here tonight saying, I'm going to prove to you, I'm going to give you proofs of the existence of God. But I'm making the assumption that God exists. And I don't have any evidence for the existence of God, but I'm going to prove to you that, well, that doesn't seem to make any sense to me. And maybe it does to you, and you could tell me later why it does, but he says, I make an assumption. He had already told us in previous statements that we can't prove it. We there's so much we don't know about it, but we're going to make an assumption that life emerged from basic raw materials and through a sequence of events that's completely consistent with the laws of nature. Well, that sounds good, but where is the proof? He went on to say, even with this scientific approach, and I would beg to differ that it's not a scientific approach, there is a possibility that we'll never know, in fact that we can't know. It is possible that life emerged by an almost infinitely improbable sequence of difficult chemical reactions. If life is the result of an infinitely improbable succession of chemical steps, then any scientific attempt to understand its life's origins is doomed to failure. Such a succession could not be duplicated in a program of lab experiments. And then, if I remember, he concluded, I believe with this, or this was my concluding slide, not necessarily his concluding statement, but notice what he said. If the origin of life was an infinitely improbable accident, which, folks, if there is no intelligence, you see, if there is no God, there is no original cause that was intelligent, because matter is dumb, okay? A rock is not smart. Air is not smart. There is no intelligence there. And so we have to believe if we're here and it's not because of a supernatural creator, then we got here through non-intelligence. Well, how did life get here? He said, well, an infinitely improbable accident. Sure wasn't an intended thing by an intelligent being. Then there's absolutely nothing you or I or anyone else could do to figure out how it happened. I must tell you, that's a depressing thought to someone like me who has devoted a decade to understanding the origin of life. This guy says, hey, I've spent 10 years studying the origin of life from an atheistic evolutionary perspective. And he had said earlier, hey, you know, we don't really know, haven't proved it, we make assumptions, this is a depressing thought. Why? Because I've spent so much time with it and still does not have the answers. Physicist Paul Davies, and I'll quote him a few more times in my next lecture, notice all the references should be on these slides so you'll understand I'm not making these quotations up. Said one of the greatest outstanding scientific mysteries is the origin of life. How did it happen? The truth is nobody has a clue. I submit to you tonight that no one has a clue who is not looking for the answers and who is not looking for the answers for the first cause outside of nature. And I believe by looking at our last law of science, the law of cause and effect, and by understanding what the law of biogenesis says, that the answer is not and cannot and has not been found and will never be found simply in nature. You know, one of the primary allegations against intelligent design is a scientific theory is testable and falsifiable, and intelligent design is not, so we shouldn't talk about this in science classes. Well, my question is, then why is the Big Bang ever talked about? And why is evolution from non-life to life talked about in science textbooks? Because it's never been proven, and all that's ever been done is proven to not fit what the facts say. Based upon all the quotations that you have looked at and heard tonight from atheistic evolutionists about their own problems with their own theory, how could anyone say that that stuff has a right to be in science textbooks when it's not even right? How do you test a Big Bang? Folks, every explosion we've ever seen doesn't cause the kind of order and design that we see in the universe. And yet we have to believe that we are the result of a cataclysmic, chaotic bang that occurred billions of years ago, and here we are today, partly because of that, originally because of that. I don't believe that makes any sense. J.W.N. Sullivan, and I've almost concluded this first lecture, wrote back in 1933. He said, "The beginning of the evolutionary process raises a question which is yet unanswerable, and I would contend is still unanswerable after 70 plus years of him making this statement. What was the origin of life on this planet until fairly recent times?" Notice he's going back talking about before the time of Pasteur and others. "Till fairly recent times, there was a pretty general belief in the occurrence of spontaneous generation. But careful experiments, notably those of Pasteur, showed that this conclusion was due to imperfect observation, and it became an accepted doctrine that life never arises except from life. So far as the actual evidence goes, this is still the only possible conclusion." And he wrote this 70 plus years ago, and I'm telling you, it's still the only possible conclusion. But since it is a conclusion that seems to lead back to some supernatural creative act, it is a conclusion that scientific men find very difficult of acceptance. Evolutionists have said, "We've been studying this for decades. I mean, for a long time. And it keeps going back to an explanation that's outside of nature, but we just can't accept that." Why? If that's where the evidence leads us, that there can't be, there's not an adequate natural explanation. Please, as we conclude tonight, look what Dr. George Wald said, Nobel laureate of Harvard University. I've got the citation for this slide on the next slide. Notice what he said several decades ago when talking about the origin of life on Earth. He said the reasonable view was to believe in spontaneous generation. The only alternative, to believe in a single primary act of supernatural creation. There is no third position. Here is an evolutionist of Harvard University from several decades ago. He said, "Listen, you've got, on one hand, you've got spontaneous generation as the origin of what caused life. On the other hand," and he says this is your only other option, "you've got, there's some supernatural creative act. Life came from non-life. Life came from a supernatural creator who's outside of nature. Those are your two options," he says. I just looked at this article just a day or two ago. And we have a copy of it in our offices from 1954, appeared in Scientific American Journal. In that same article, he said, "Most modern biologists, having reviewed with satisfaction the downfall of the spontaneous generation hypothesis, yet unwilling to accept the alternative belief in special creation, are left with nothing." So he says, wait a second. We see the downfall of spontaneous generation. We've never seen life come from non-life. Never happens in nature. Never seen it before. Furthermore, life always comes from the same kind of life, meaning humans have humans and dogs have dogs and cats have cats. And then he concluded, "I think a scientist has no choice but to approach the origin of life through a hypothesis of spontaneous generation." Well, why is that the case? Because the other alternative leads back to a supernatural creator? Yes, I believe, just as this evolutionist several decades ago said, that if spontaneous generation is not true, then it points back to the fact that there must be some explanation outside of nature to have caused life to exist in the universe and caused the universe to begin with. Thank you very much for your kind attention this first period. Really appreciate you being here. You've been a wonderful, kind audience. If you have questions, I'll be happy to talk to people in between. I'm not going to have much time, really, because we're already about 5 minutes past schedule, but I'll be happy to stick around tonight after the second lecture. I hope that you can. In this second lecture, we're going to talk about really another truism, another, I believe, truth that design demands a designer. We'll talk about that more in that lecture. We'll take about a 5-minute break, hopefully get started back around 8:10. Thank you very much.